either side of his left wrist as they jolted into the air and saw that it was midnight. He knew he was in for a whipping, dipping, stomach-lurching half-hour flight, followed by a 3-hour walk through ragged trails before arriving on target sometime around 3:30 a.m. In seconds, the ground below disappeared at the portal in the closed hatch next to Quart's head, and the lights below went dark, replaced by the impenetrable cloud cover. He closed his eyes, an attempt to calm himself, but quickly Hightower came over the interteam radio.
"Pilot says he's going lights out. It will be NODs from here on. 35 minutes to target."
The blinking lights on the outside of the helo turned off. The lights in the cabin around Quart did the same, and they flew through blackness towards the unknown. 53. 3 hours later, and 170 kilometers away, a different helicopter tracked over terrain with its own lights off, its pilot and co-pilot navigating the way through their windscreen with the aid of their single-tube, helmet-mounted night vision monocles. The Bell 412 flew just 3 meters over the Ismail Zai Agency Road, following every turn of the blacktop as it ventured to the west. The pilot kept his airspeed around 100 kilometers an hour, about the same ground speed as a wheeled vehicle would travel around here, so any satellite or drone flying above would assume the helo to be just another car or truck on the road. The pilot of the single-rotor Huey variant was Omar Mufti, a former major in the Pakistan Army Aviation Corps and second-in-command of the Kashmiri Resistance Front. In the Army, Mufti had normally flown the larger and more advanced Mi-17, a Russian transport and gunship helo, but his nation had many other aircraft, and Mufti had procured this Huey for this evening's work because of its small size, its nimble maneuvering, and the fact that he had no equipment to carry. He and his co-pilot did have one passenger, however. 35-year-old Murad Khan, formerly of the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency and now the leader of the KRF, sat in back looking out at complete darkness because he wasn't wearing NODs like the pilots. Khan worked hard to keep himself calm, but it became harder to do so when he received word through his headset that everything at his destination was ready and they were only waiting on his arrival to begin tonight's operation. Khan was certain his actions early this morning would be the greatest achievement any Pakistani had made to his nation's national security, since another emigre from India had single-handedly delivered nuclear technology and then nuclear weapons into the nation's arsenal. A.Q. Khan was no relative of Murad Khan. It was a common surname for Muslims in the region. But the younger man felt that after tonight, he would go down in history along with the now 72-year-old hero of the nation. Not that he did any of this for Pakistan. The government in power, as far as he was concerned, was weak and useless. They, along with previous administrations, had refused to fight India for Khan's territorial homeland, refused to lift a finger for any of the Muslims on the other side of the border. He'd committed attacks against Pakistan in an attempt to weaken the government and sow terror, but by tonight's action, he hoped to, in one fell swoop, push America's assistance away from Pakistan and wound them deeply. Then, God willing, he would have the freedom to go after an even bigger threat to his people, to his religion, India. But India was for another day. Now the target was the American coalition. This mission of Khan's was in no way sanctioned by the ISI, but through the years of building contacts, he'd determined that he could use his Kashmiri roots to found a new organization. One that pretended to be nothing more than a relatively unsophisticated, ideologically motivated terror faction, remaining on the low end of the spectrum behind other Pakistani militant groups, like Lashkar-e-Taiba and Tehrik-e-Taliban. Until the day Murad Khan painted his masterpiece. And that day was this day. Murad Khan shuddered with anticipation of what was to come in the next few hours. Omar Mufti piloted his Bell helicopter through the western front gates of Ismail Zai at 3 a.m., right on time, flying now just a single meter over the ground at a speed of only 30 kilometers per hour. They continued on, proceeding along a broken and weed-strewn asphalt runway that ran the length of the property, appearing to anyone watching the heat signature through the clouds above to be a small truck, similar to a dozen or more that had arrived in the past day. He flew this way through the base, past the command building on his left, past the tower above the runway on his right, past the barracks and the storage building, and then onto the massive bunker on the far eastern side. Mufti finally put his skids down just short of the huge aircraft hangar doors of the largest structure in the property. He shut the helicopter down and left his co-pilot behind to refuel it and ready it for another flight, because they planned on leaving with Khan within the next 30 minutes. The former Aviation Corps major climbed out of the pilot's door while the rotors slowed above him. Khan opened the rear hatch simultaneously, and the men met on the concrete tarmac in front of the hardened bunker, just as a smaller double garage door opened closer to them, right next to the three-story blast doors. Khan looked up to the sky, and then, with a wide grin, he turned his attention to Mufti. Shouting over the still spooling down engine, Khan said,
"We have been blessed tonight with the weather, my brother."
"Truly we have," Mufti said. "It will be difficult where the men have to go with these low clouds, but the clouds ensure they will at least have a chance."
Khan grabbed him on both shoulders and embraced him tightly.
"Confidence, my friend. The men you have chosen for the job will be successful. I know it."
Together they walked through the garage doors and into the well-lit bunker, and they both quickly noticed the contrast. Other than the still spooling down helo, it was quiet and still and dark outside. Inside, in a space the size of a small sports stadium, generators powered dozens of light towers, and nearly 100 men moved around, making last-minute preparations. Most of the men were fighters, the best soldiers of the Kashmiri Resistance Front, already dressed in full battle gear and carrying AK-47s or PKM light machine guns, along with the steely-eyed looks of men who knew they were likely going to be in a fight before the night was through. But most of these men had other tasks as well. They were mechanics, technicians, logistics, transportation. The men had arrived here, one vehicle at a time, over the space of a week and a half, never more than 4 vehicles a day, and never separated by less than 5 hours. By this bit of subterfuge, they'd been able to amass a large presence here in the hardened bunker and remained hidden from American drones and satellites, but this had not been easy. Food, tea, and water had come from the village of Kayla, 8 kilometers to the northeast, handed over by women to the men in each car as it passed the village, where it was taken into the bunker and consumed. The men at Ismail Zai had never even used a tunnel that led from a tiny postage stamp of a village to the north into the command building to store their human waste. It was known that the Americans had discovered the tunnel and its access in the command building when they'd raided this base the previous month. So the tunnel had been sealed at the northern end, outside the base, and since then, it had become a place to store bucket after bucket of shit, so that the Americans wouldn't spot a massive latrine or burning waste from the air. Instead, the men erected a smaller latrine outside, subterfuge to fool the coalition over the border of their numbers. Khan was so fearful of American drones and satellites that he'd even planned this mission for the cloud cover that came inevitably over the area most every night in October. And he'd made certain that movement around the facility outside the hardened aircraft structure would be kept to a minimum. That was until early the previous morning, when 12 large trucks had arrived, 9 of which pulled a flatbed trailer and a payload covered by a thick canopy to make identification of the contents impossible. The arrival of the trucks had been spaced apart so as not to be noticed as a convoy on the road, and they were out of sight just moments after entering the base at Ismail Zai, having pulled straight into the bunker. But the trucks had made it into the hardened shelter unmolested, and then the covers had been removed from the flatbeds and the contents organized. These 9 vehicles then left, one by one, and eventually the contents were assembled by Kashmiri separatist mechanics who had worked for the Army Aviation Corps under Omar Mufti, before themselves going AWOL to serve in the KRF. And now, just inside the protection of the hardened bunker, Murad Khan put his hands on his hips and stared at the glorious sight in front of him. There, under the light of several high flood lamps, he gazed upon his entire mission, the components for tonight's action that would elevate his plan and Khan himself into the ranks of legend. There were 4 of them, and to Khan, they were beautiful. Large, dual-rotor helicopters sat one in front of the other, the first aircraft's front rotor just 10 meters from the inside of the blast doors, all their noses pointed forward as if they were horses at the starting gate ready to launch. The aircraft were dark and still, but massive and foreboding. Each rotor was 50 feet in diameter, and the fuselages of the helicopters were 45 feet in length. These were Boeing Vertol models, old but reliable variants of the American Chinook, and they had been purchased in secret by Pakistani intelligence agents from the Royal Thai Army under Khan's instruction, then dismantled and secretly transported by container ship to Pakistan months earlier. In a chop shop in Karachi, the Thai tiger stripe pattern on the fuselage had been painted over, and now all four reassembled helicopters in front of Murad Khan were red and white in color, and they bore the insignia of Chesapeake Aviation, Inc., an American civilian transport company ubiquitous just over the border. These BV-107s were, in every outward appearance, identical to the Chesapeake helos that ferried troops and other coalition personnel throughout Afghanistan, and they would serve as Murad Khan's Trojan horses tonight. Khan could not see inside any of the aircraft from his vantage point, but he knew what they contained. Each of the first three large transports was loaded with a single 2,000-kilo ammonium nitrate fuel oil bomb, roughly the size of a full-sized car. And each of these ANFO devices was lined and packed with dozens of kilograms of high-level radioactive waste. Khan smiled as he looked upon the helicopters, because this was a scene that he had imagined in his mind's eye for over a year now. All three targets tonight had been selected by Khan personally. The first helicopter to take off would fly to the northwest, and it would also have the longest distance to travel. It would then detonate over Bagram, the largest U.S. military base in Afghanistan. Hundreds of Americans would die, and the base and much of its equipment would be rendered untouchable for 100 years or more. The second BV-107 in the air would head half the distance of the first flight to the large U.S. military base in Jalalabad. Its detonation was designed to kill hundreds more, and similarly contaminate all the territory and equipment there. A third helo in line would head west to just over the border in Kunar province, where it would, near simultaneously with the others, detonate over forward operating base Bostik, a small but important U.S. military outpost from where many attacks into Pakistan had originated. The lead housing surrounding each weapon kept the pilots and crew safe, at least until they neared their destinations. When they were within 15 minutes of their targets, a technician on board each of the aircraft would attach the detonator and hold it in his hand until the order came from the pilot to trigger it. It would be a trifecta of blows to America, all in a single night. It would kill thousands, render billions of dollars of military hardware inoperable, deny valuable territory to the Americans, and hopefully spell the end for the presence of the meddling infidels here in the region. There was a fourth helicopter, and initially Khan had intended for it, too, to be carrying an identical radioactive dispersal device. The plan was to fly due west to coast and detonate over U.S. Special Forces Base Salerno. But he found himself one bomb short and with a helicopter all dressed up with nowhere to go. Utterly destroying this military base to the south of the others, with a dirty bomb no less, would have been grand, and Murad Khan was bothered that Salerno had been granted a reprieve from his massive attack. But he had seen no alternative. Fully a fourth of his ammonium nitrate had been sacrificed in Lahore to lead the CIA away from the rest of the stolen chemicals, hopefully to buy some time to move into the execution phase of the operation. And his organization's theft of radioactive waste at the disposal site at Chajma the previous month had yielded only enough material for three dirty bombs of the yield he felt was necessary to send the right message to the coalition. So Khan had three enormous radioactive dispersal devices built, ensuring maximum impact at Bagram, Jalalabad, and Bostik, but that was not to say he had no plan for the fourth helo in the line. The last of the four helicopters had been loaded with 10 125mm high-explosive tank shells stolen by the KRF from stores used by T-80 battle tanks at a base in Abbottabad, then all wired together by the same Egyptian bomb maker who'd created the RDDs. The fourth helo was a conventional vehicle-borne improvised explosive device. Other than the fact it was being flown in a helicopter, it was similar to any massive VBIED employed by any one of numerous insurgent organizations in the region, but it would still cause impressive damage to U.S. Special Operations Forces in Afghanistan. Salerno wouldn't be destroyed, but it would be suitably punished. The 70 armed men here in the bunker who would not be boarding a helicopter tonight had one job only: to ensure that the four helicopters made it safely in the air if the Americans attacked Ismail Zai before takeoff. As soon as the helos were safely launched, Khan and Mufti would climb back into the Huey to fly to nearby Peshawar, where they planned to disappear into the metropolis around the time the unspeakable carnage in the West was being carried out. They'd lay low there for a while and then slip out of Peshawar, back east into Kashmir, where they could simply melt away among their people. If all went to plan, Khan told himself now as he looked at the fruit of all his labors inside the bunker, 1 week from today, this part of the world could be a very different place, and he could find himself in a very different station in life as well. As he stood there, admiring all he had accomplished so far, Nasser Rasool stepped up to him, and Khan embraced the younger man.
"Assalamu alaikum."
"Wa alaikum assalam," came the reply.
Rasool was, simply put, Murad Khan's ace in the hole. He was Kashmiri, but not particularly zealous, a young technical specialist in the Pakistani army who had been sent to China to learn from some of the best military information technology specialists in the world. He was taught techniques and tactics that he then brought back to the ISI to bolster his home nation's counter-security apparatus. ISI officer Murad Khan had worked with Rasool on an operation in Germany a few years prior, and he'd found the young man invaluable and brilliant. Khan immediately handpicked him out of the army to work for the Foreign Coordination Unit. When Rasool wanted a new piece of equipment, Khan made certain he acquired it for him, be it from China or France or Russia. Rasool protected Khan's operations, he counseled Khan on ways to employ technology to achieve his aims, and he ran counterintelligence for all of Khan's dealings, professional and personal. While all this was happening, Khan was working Nasser Rasool, indoctrinating him to the fact that they had to go against the stated wishes of their nation in order to rid his people of one of their greatest threats, American intervention. The younger man was not interested in politics, but after years of Khan showing him the effects of U.S. drone strikes that killed civilians, Rasool was converted into his zealotry. Rasool worshipped the ground upon which Khan walked. He'd joined his organization, leaving the ISI behind, because Khan promised they would all be considered heroes by the nation of Pakistan and by the people of Kashmir when tonight's mission was complete.
"The men in the command building are ready to begin, sir,"
Nasir said now, pride evident on his face and in his tone. Khan had no need to go to the command building to check for himself. Nasir had a team of 8 Chinese technicians he'd hired, along with the jamming equipment that came to the Pakistan Army a month before and was then reappropriated to the Foreign Coordination Unit. These men knew nothing about radioactive waste attacks against America. They only knew their own role tonight. Khan patted his young technician on the shoulder to calm him.
"So, Nasir, my friend, you are saying we are ready?"
"Ready, sir. When you give the order, we will begin thermal spoofing. The satellite jamming will commence, and then the delivery vehicles can be safely brought out of the bunker for fueling and takeoff."
"Excellent," Khan said. "Let us begin."
54. Present day. 47-year-old Murad Khan stood on the 25th floor of the express tower of Nariman Point, taking in the view. The other side of the large office had floor-to-ceiling windows that displayed the beautiful vista of the harbor, but Khan stood on the northern side of the building and looked out over the city of 12 million souls. The decision the Pakistan National wrestled with now was truly the hardest in his life. His bomb was ready, and it was nearby. Today was the day he'd planned on detonating it to cripple his archenemy, the nation of his birth. But the storm had disrupted his plans. On the one hand, he could stand down, wait for better weather conditions, and then achieve his objective. But on the other hand, he could feel the authorities closing in on him. He knew that B Company's feeble attempts to protect his mission here, their failure to kill Appleton and the henchmen working for him who had caused so much trouble, and even their inability to hold on to a young and untrained girl told him that he couldn't trust the dozens of Indians at his disposal to protect his mission for another day. He trusted only the 12 security men he'd brought along from Pakistan, and most of all, he trusted Nasser Rasool. The Indian gangsters were just fools. They didn't even know what his true mission was here in Mumbai. Only their leader, Palak Bari, knew that. B Company had served their purpose. They stole fuel rods from Trombay. They'd purchased and taken delivery of black market RDX explosives from Algiers and detonators from a Swiss manufacturer. They'd provided Khan with a warehouse where a Syrian bomb maker, paid for by Bari himself, had come to assemble the device, using his education as an electrical engineer in Germany to combine the nuclear fuel rods with the explosives, wiring everything up with a high-tech remote detonation system that only Khan had access to. B Company goons had even transported the device, though they had no idea what it was. A 40-foot shipping container weighing 8 tons was moved by crane onto a heavy-duty flatbed truck, then brought to the building construction site right next door to where Khan now stood. Another crane removed the shipping container and placed it on a construction hoist attached to the side of a 33-floor skyscraper 3/4 of the way through its construction process, then lifted it to the 32nd floor, where a hydraulic loader was waiting to move it through the building, placing it where it would be most effective. Now, 100 meters north of where Khan stood, and 7 floors above him, the project he'd been planning for 12 years now waited for his signal. But the damn monsoon presented a problem. The wind blew hard from the southwest now. It would blow harder still through the afternoon and evening, and the rain was still several hours off. Wind wasn't necessarily a bad thing for a man intent on detonating a dirty bomb on a high floor of an open building. Obviously, the intent was exposure. But Murad Khan's plan was to irradiate Nariman Point and the southern quadrant of the city and leave the slums to the north intact and safe. 80-kilometer winds blowing from the water towards the northeast would ensure that the entire city, all 12 million residents, would be subjected to exposure. The death toll of Muslims, who were poor and had little access to medical care and no ability to simply move their families and their lives out of the city, would be catastrophic. And Murad Khan was trying to wrap his head around this. Delaying until tomorrow gave his enemies more time to stop him. Going forward today, now even, meant quite literally overkill. Nasser Rasool stepped up to him. The 38-year-old had a lot of worry on his face, but Khan was accustomed to this look.
What is it? Work is halted next door. The crews have been sent home, so our men there will stand out if they're spotted. The cranes and heavy equipment are pinned down, so there is no quick escape. Plastic sheeting has been erected on the higher floors where the windows will go, but 80-kilometer winds will tear that out. Your point, my friend. We have to wait until tomorrow.
Khan looked at his young protege.
This isn't about a threat to our security. This is your concern about the fallout.
Rasool shrugged.
You are Kashmiri. Why do you care about the people of Mumbai? The Muslims, sir.
Khan looked back out the window. The winds were already high, the air cloudy and wet. In the distance he could see Dharavi, the slum where Palak Bari himself had grown up. Bari had helped orchestrate today's attack from his home in Karachi, as a paymaster, as a benefactor to Khan, and as an arranger for local assets. But Bari had made one stipulation. Dharavi was not to be affected by the blast. Khan had readily made that promise and positioned his device in the financial center on Nariman Point so that the fallout wouldn't move too far inland. But the monsoon had come like a curse, and the monsoon assured that if Khan did go through with the attack today, then Palak Bari and his henchmen would hunt him down to the ends of the earth. Before Khan could speak, Rasool said,
"If we detonate in monsoon winds, Bari will hold us personally responsible for the devastation."
Imploringly, he said,
"We must wait till the weather passes. We must wait until tomorrow."
"Do you think Theodore Appleton is waiting until tomorrow to notify the authorities about what he knows?"
Rasool countered.
"B Company has multiple contacts in the local and federal police. They have reported no indication that anyone is aware of our activities."
"That can change at any time. And when it does change, when the B Company lieutenants working for us under Jay learn what we have in store for their city, what then? Then it won't be Appleton we have to worry about. It won't be the police. It won't even be Bari back in Karachi. It will be our benefactors here. Every hour we wait, every minute we wait, we come closer to losing everything."
Rasool wasn't giving up.
15 hours. Tomorrow morning the winds will be calm. 20 kilometers or less. Then we detonate the device."
Khan looked back out the window at the city. He was unsure, and he was seldom unsure. Finally, however, he said,
"We keep security around the bomb. B Company on the outer ring, our men in the inner ring. They will just have to weather the storm in the construction site. You and I will stay here in the penthouse tonight, ready to initiate the detonation sequence if B Company sources alert us to any problems. We watch the weather closely, and as soon as the monsoon passes us and heads to the northeast, we initiate the device right behind it. Rasul nodded, relieved. I think that is very wise. Of course you do, Khan said with a little smile. It was your idea.
Court Gentry and Priyanka Bhandari arrived in Nariman Point in a stolen Ford Econoline van, pulled into an empty taxi stand a block south of the building with the B Company-owned penthouse, and parked along the tree-lined promenade that ringed the swelling and choppy waters of Back Bay. From here they had a view not only of the tower to the northeast, but also, looking southwest, of the apocalyptic-looking clouds still out to sea but rolling ominously in this direction. There was still some traffic on the roads, and this made Court confident enough to drive here and to park here, but he didn't plan on staying long. He'd hoped to reconnoiter the area on foot to get an idea of the security presence, if any, at the location, and to make a judgment as to whether this building was, in fact, where Khan was hiding out. He liked it as a potential target location because while B Company owned the penthouse on the top floor, they did not own or control the rest of the building. If Khan was here, he was protected, but he was protected in the penthouse. Court started to climb out of the van, but Priya took him by his arm.
One white man walking alone down here as a monsoon blows ashore? Does that make sense to you?
What do you suggest?
Express Tower 1 is a residential and office building. Let me do a little research on who lives and works there. If we can find someone who will invite us in, we can get inside the building itself, and then I can hack into their closed-circuit camera.
Don't you need to do that from their security office?
Priya shook her head.
Access to the CCTV data will be shared not only with the building security, but also with large offices inside the building. Private companies want to see the cameras on their floors, so the main system will be accessible from any number of workstations in that high-rise. I just have to get into the terminal, then swim upriver with some tools I have right here.
She held up a thumb drive. Court shook his head.
I like your thinking, but you can't go in that building. You spent 2 days in the hands of the assholes I'm hunting. They don't know what I look like, but they sure as hell know you. If the wrong guy happens to be walking through the lobby, someone who saw you in Andari East, then we're screwed.
He repeated himself with authority.
You can't go in.
Priya reached into her purse and pulled out a long veil. Wrapping it around her face and head, she tied it and tucked it into her top. Court just nodded, impressed.
Never mind then. You can come with me.
She rolled her eyes, pulled out her laptop, linked it to the wireless radio on her phone, and went to work. Minutes later, Priya was talking, having an animated phone conversation with someone she had not yet identified to Cobalt. When she hung up, she said,
I called a real estate management company that owns some condos on the lower floors of the building. They are closed today because of the storm, but I told them I was your translator, and you had come all the way from America and wanted to look at one or two more properties before you left tomorrow.
But if they're closed?
I was persistent. I told him you were worried about living so close to the water, considering the possibility of monsoons. He took that as a challenge. He told me he'd have someone unlock a furnished model, and we could ride out the storm in it for a couple of hours.
Court was more than impressed. They climbed out of the Econoline on Marine Drive, leaning into a wind that seemed to be growing by the minute. There were still quite a few people on the street, even entering and exiting the 25-story tower in front of them, but Court knew that this area, so close to the water, would be all but impassable when the rains came. A man at the security desk in the lobby called the name given to Priya by the real estate broker, and a few minutes later, a woman came down the elevator and brought Priya and Court inside. Her English was good. She was chatty, mostly about the impending weather, as they took the elevator up to the 6th floor. Here, she unlocked the door to a condo and told the couple to make themselves at home to watch the storm roll in. She said she'd be back to check on them later, and then she left them alone. Priya looked around.
I need an office, not an apartment. Someplace large. A call center. Looking at the floor plan in the van, I saw one on the 9th floor that looks like it will be big enough.
Why does it have to be big?
because I need access to a computer hardwired into the security system, and to get that access, I need to find someone's login credentials.
How do you...
Can we just go?
Court laughed a little. Listen, you and I have to sell the fact that we're a couple. She cocked her head a little.
Meaning?
There are security cameras all over this place. I guarantee B Company has access to the feeds. We can't look like we're snooping around.
We'll have to break into the office. I'm sure they're closed because of the storm.
Court said, I'll get us in, but on the way there, we need to act naturally. The two of them headed back outside the condo and into the elevator. Court was painfully aware of the security cameras here in the hallways of the building, so he portrayed himself as exactly the opposite of a man who was about to break into anything. For her part, Priya played her role well. They chatted lightly, even as they left the elevator on the 9th floor and began looking for a suitable office. There was no door to pick because the entire floor belonged to a call center. Hundreds of desks with computers were situated in a large room, with executive offices, many with their doors left open, along the wall. Court and Priya walked back to a corner that gave them a view to the north and to the west, and here, Priya went from terminal to terminal. Court looked on but didn't interrupt her. At each desk, she pulled open the top drawer to the right of the chair, fumbled around through paperwork a moment, and then moved on to the next. On her 9th try, she found what she was looking for. Triumphantly, she waved a single handwritten note in the air.
Studies show that workers often leave their login info somewhere easily accessible. Nobody's too worried about someone sneaking in and doing their job for them, I guess.
Court's own knowledge of social engineering confirmed this. People tended to freely or easily give up information about themselves in many ways, but laziness and braggadocio were the two most common. It took her a moment to boot up the computer and get inside. Once there, she quickly looked over the applications installed.
Perfect. Their computers are already tied into the building system, so they can have access to the cameras at the elevator bank. They are locked out of the rest of the feeds, but that's no problem for me.
She added,
This is almost too easy.
Court stood 30 feet away, looking out the window towards the bay.
This is going to be one hell of a storm.
Without looking up, she said,
That's what I've been telling you.
Yeah.
He glanced to his right, facing the north in the corner office, and was surprised to see an even taller building next door to Express Tower. It was positioned slightly to the northeast, and he hadn't been able to see it from the street on the other side of the building he was in now. It was still under construction, however, and surrounded by cranes and building materials fenced in all around. No one was working at the site at the moment, obviously because of the approaching monsoon.
Court said, What's that?
Priya looked out the window.
The building? I don't know.
Court looked at the area around it.
It's on the same property as this one. Looks similar in style, too.
Priya pulled up the area on Google Maps, but there was nothing there on the satellite image.
This sat photo is from a year ago. It was just an empty site then, but yeah, it looks like the land belongs to the same people who own Express Tower.
She spent the next few seconds performing a Google search.
Here it is. Express Tower 2. It's 8 stories taller. 33 floors in all. Supposed to be ready in a year and a half.
She went back to accessing the CCTV system. After a moment, however, the man she knew as Cobalt spoke.
If the bomb is in this building, in the penthouse or on the roof at the top of this building, like we thought, how did it get there?
B Company brought it.
Right, but if it's going to be effective, it will need to weigh several tons.
Priya looked up at Cobalt now.
You could bring it up one piece at a time.
If you had to, maybe you could haul the component parts and build the device on site. But what if you didn't have to?
What are you getting at?
Right there, he pointed.
Priya stood and walked over to the corner window. Cobalt was indicating the construction to the north. He said,
Hammerhead tower cranes that size can lift 10 tons. Hydraulic winches, pneumatic hoists. All that equipment over there could easily transport a massive bomb to the top floor of that structure.
How do you know so much about heavy construction?
A past life,
he said cryptically. In truth, he'd spent a lot of time working in cover around shipyards, and much of the equipment for moving shipping containers was similar to that used in construction. Court looked higher on the building and saw that the top several floors were open to the elements, though plastic sheeting blew in the heavy winds. He said,
A perfect scenario.
What do you mean?
You wouldn't have to put the bomb on the roof, where it could be detected by aircraft or exposed to the weather. You could put it on one of the top floors that are open. Blow it. The radioactive cloud goes in all directions.
Priya said, But Khan wouldn't do that in the middle of a monsoon, would he? With these winds, it would blow inland for tens of kilometers, in fact millions. Millions who couldn't be decontaminated because India doesn't have the infrastructure to deal with that.
Kort thought it over.
I learned a long time ago not to underestimate Murad Khan's capacity to do anything really bad.
He turned to Priya. Can you find out who owns that building? She said.
It doesn't matter who owns it. It's not occupied yet.
But...
B Company has a stranglehold on the construction industry in Mumbai. They could easily use that building for their own designs, and the owners wouldn't know about it.
Kort kept looking out the window. The high jibs of the cranes swiveled slightly, back and forth in the wind.
What do you want to do?
She asked.
We call Ted. Tell him to get the police to Tower 2 now. I know that bomb is up there. I don't know when they plan on detonating it.
And after we call Ted?
I'm going over there. Alone.
Priya squinted into the dimming light outside as the black clouds rolled over.
There's nothing going on over there right now. Even if the device is there, I don't see anybody around.
If the device is there, Kort said, then Khan has posted security. We just can't see them from here.
What can I do?
You can stay here. Get into the camera system at this location. I want to see anyone coming or going in this storm. Anyone coming or going up in the penthouse. Be careful.
He slipped in an earpiece.
You can alert me if you see anything.
Priya said.
How will you get into that construction site?
I'll jump a fence and go through the front door if I don't see any security. Otherwise, I'll wing it.
As he walked out the door, she said.
You be careful.
He sniffed out a laugh and left the room. 55. 12 years ago. At 3 a.m., Kort Gentry walked in silence and in darkness, first in line of his six-man unit as they made their way through a pine forest on a rocky hill. They'd been humping for over 2.5 hours now, bypassing any buildings or sign of human activity, which had thankfully been few and far between. The helicopters that had dropped them in this rugged terrain had returned back through the mountains and over the border into Afghanistan, and both the Rangers and the SEALs had been dropped off to the south, so it was just Lima Foxtrot and Golf Sierra walking together here, single file and spaced over a few dozen meters through a dark and misty night. Kort thought about the nicknames for the two teams Julie had mentioned, the Lucky Fuckers and the Goon Squad. It made him smile a little. They used no lights, only their NODs showed them the way. And although everyone had said the terrain here made for an easy 5-mile walk, to Kort this seemed pretty damn difficult. They'd negotiated rocky paths, crossed a shallow but fast-moving stream, climbed hills, and descended into rutted valleys as they'd made their way in nearly complete blackness. He was in peak physical condition, and he was 15 years younger than many of the men around him, but he could feel the weight of his gear and the ache in his calves as he neared their target. As they entered the last half mile before they would have visual on Ismail Zai, he heard Zach Hightower's voice in his headset, transmitting back to the talk at Chapman.
Golf Sierra Actual for home plate. Home plate, send your traffic, Sierra Actual. Be advised, Golf Sierra and Lima Foxtrot are at phase line echo. Lima Foxtrot separating at this time, over.
The response came from the talk at Camp Chapman seconds later.
Understood, Sierra Actual. All forces have reported in. Still heavy cloud cover at the target, but thermal imagery showing increased activity. Personnel and unidentified vehicles present. How copy?
Good copy, homeplate. We will advise at phase line Omega.
Roger that. Happy hunting. Homeplate out.
Kort watched while Hightower and Anderson shook hands, and then the two ground branch teams went their separate ways, Golf Sierra continuing north through the piney hillside and Lima Foxtrot south towards a stream that ran east to west through lower ground. Just inside the colossal blast doors of the hardened aircraft shelter, Murad Khan stood with Omar Mufti and Nasser Rasool. The younger man grabbed a walkie-talkie from his hip and gave an order, speaking in Arabic, and then repeating himself in Urdu. Within seconds, four Toyota pickups rolled by on their way out the smaller exit near the three-story blast doors, each one carrying several men in the truck bed. The trucks peeled off in different directions and began driving around the several acres of paved and grassy space between the northern side of the bunker and the north wall of the compound. A dozen large metal dumpsters had been filled with old truck tires, and the men in the back of the trucks used burning torches to light them one by one. Several large grassy spaces in front of the hardened bunker and alongside the apron and taxiway were waist-high and unmaintained, and they'd also been soaked with gasoline, so when the men in the pickups lit them, it created billowing smoke that mixed with the smoke coming from the tire fires assembled in the past few days and only doused with gas after dark this evening, and it took the vehicles some minutes to set it all alight. The last to be set on fire were piles and piles of tires just outside the bunker, and as their flames grew and their black smoke rose, further obscuring any view from above, the eight rotors of the four big helicopters behind the blast doors began to spin. The plan was to have the two fuel trucks roll out of the blast doors first, then the first of the Chinooks. All four of the aircraft had been loaded with enough fuel for their taxi out to the apron, but no more, because Mufti declared it too dangerous to fully fuel the helicopters in an enclosed space. The first Hilo would finish fueling and then take to the air 10 minutes after the blast doors opened. It would fly immediately to Bagram, arriving over the airfield in under 1 hour. Then the Jalalabad aircraft would leave 10 minutes after that, hitting at the same time as the first flight, and then the third aircraft, this one targeting Camp Bostic, would leave 10 minutes later. The fourth flight, heading to Camp Salerno, would leave as soon as the helicopter going to Bostic cleared the sky above the base. Khan didn't like any bit of this operation being seen from the air, even with the thermal spoofing, even with the jamming, even with the cloud cover. He knew it wouldn't take the coalition over the border in Afghanistan long to work around the jamming, and he wanted to have a failsafe, so the burning tires and smoke in addition to the cloud cover would serve to further blind overhead eyes. Mufti appeared in front of him, a radio in his hand.
"I will let the smoke build over the base for a few more minutes, then call for the doors to be opened," he smiled. "We will be triumphant." "I have no doubt, and I also have no doubt that we will someday soon see all your valiant pilots in paradise."
Mufti nodded with purpose, checked his watch, then spoke into his radio.
10 minutes until taxi."
Khan looked to Nasir.
"Tell the Chinese in the command building to initiate satellite jamming."
Nasir did so via his walkie-talkie, speaking English to the hired technicians. A response came in English.
"Jamming initiated."
Khan could feel the nerves of the younger man standing next to him, so he said,
"It was inevitable the Americans would see that something was happening here tonight. I knew better than to underestimate them. Now they won't know what is going on until it is far too late."
Nasir said,
"They'll send men, tonight even. They'll have to know we have an operation imminent." "I am sure you are right. By then, however, you and I will be gone."
Nasir nodded, smiled nervously, then went back to his radio to check with his guests from China. Back at the talk, a state of pandemonium erupted. All monitors showing real-time images at Ismail Zai from the pair of Reaper UAVs were blacked out, and efforts to reach the four forces converging on the target had been unsuccessful. Hanley shouted over the loud clamor in the room.
"Who the fuck can jam our Reapers?"
"The Chinese," Vance said, then added, "In theory. Sat jamming can be defeated. It will just take some time to retask equipment in geosynchronous orbit."
Hanley had read the cable from Appleton 2 days before about the purchase of Chinese satellite jamming equipment by the Pakistani army. Vance had read it too.
"It's the PAC army," Vance declared.
But Hanley shook his head.
"This isn't the PAC army. This is Khan. He must have gotten the jamming equipment from the army."
He looked to Vance now.
"We have to get an Air Force overflight. We need eyeballs on that site."
Vance was against this.
"Surface-to-air missiles in Peshawar. SA-7s. A C-130 flying over into Khyber. Even an F-16 wouldn't stand a chance. The Reapers are programmed to return to base if they lose comms. They'll be back here in 30 minutes.
How long to reestablish comms over Ismail Zai?"
Hanley demanded. Vance picked up a phone.
"I've got to call Langley, get all traffic sent to another sat. This will take 20 to 30 minutes minimum.
Shit,"
Hanley said, and behind him, Julie Marquez looked down at her blank screen. She'd been afraid the KRF was more prepared for whatever they had planned tonight than the Coalition was, and now she feared all she could do was simply wait to react to their next move. Hanley turned around and faced her now, gave her a look that told her she'd been right all along. Softly, she said,
"They were ready for us."
Hanley nodded, turned away. To the room, he said,
"We have 76 troops converging on that target. They are on their own until we get back online. Be ready to support them as soon as we have some means of doing so."
56. Present day. Ted Appleton had spent the day forcing himself to conduct the tradecraft that had been a part of his life since his mid-20s. It got harder as one got older. The SDRs, the aimlessly moving around nowhere for hours, looking for any evidence of a tail. But he was a man on autopilot. Even if every fiber of his being told him he didn't have time for this shit, he had to rush, he had to act now. He'd contacted an old Indian acquaintance, a respected Tamil case officer in RNAW named Daruk Raja, and he asked him for a clandestine call on Signal. Raja complied immediately, asked what he could do for his old friend, and then Appleton told him he'd picked up intelligence chatter that Murad Khan was alive and operating with B Company here in the city. His contact was taken aback for two reasons. One, Appleton had communicated with Raja a dozen times in the past few months, ostensibly to get unclassified background information or even random scuttlebutt that might help him with his job working in nuclear non-proliferation, and he'd never mentioned Khan. And two, well, RNAW, Raja claimed, had no information whatsoever to corroborate the fact that Khan was alive and well anywhere, much less here in Mumbai. He was interested in whatever Appleton had on the subject, that much was clear, because he immediately asked for an in-person meeting, a rare occurrence for an intelligence transaction between the two men. Ted didn't like the risk and the delay of a face-to-face meeting, but his contact at RNAW was old school, older than Appleton himself, but still very much in the game, and he was a trusted friend. Daruk Raja let Appleton choose the time and place for the meet to ease the American's mind about the situation, and now, at 4 p.m., the American had finished his SDR, and he stood in a camel raincoat, an umbrella under his arm, and under the semi-protection of the roof over the entrance to the Mumbai Devi Temple. It was in the center of a large market area, and the men had met here before for clandestine communications. But today, all the stalls were shuttered or tarped over or otherwise broken down to weather the storm. Normally, this would be an incredibly lively place, but the weather had turned it into a virtual ghost town, something Appleton had expected somewhat, but not to this degree. His phone rang, and he saw it was Priya. When he answered, she told him Cobalt now suspected that Khan's device was at the top of Express Tower 2. He assured her he was moments away from speaking with the right person, and he would get authorities on the way to the construction site. As he hung up the call, an SUV pulled up in front of the temple, the driver's window rolled down, and Daruk Raja waved to Appleton and bade him forward into the car. The window immediately rose back up. The American headed for the SUV, fighting the wind for control of his balance. He finally made it to the vehicle, opening the front passenger side door and climbing in. He was unaware of the second SUV that had pulled up behind him. He reached for the door to pull it closed, but as he began to do so, he saw that Raja had climbed out of the driver's side and walked around to Ted's door. The man leaned over, close to Appleton, his wispy thin hair blowing wildly in the wind. He said,
"I'm sorry, old friend. You know how it is. How they can get to you, wear you down over time."
A big Indian man entered the driver's side door and sat down, and a second man sat in the back, directly behind him. Appleton did understand. He recognized the rough fit and finish of B Company thugs, and he knew he'd been double-crossed. The SUV lurched forward. The RNAW man was left behind in the wind, and the man in the back behind Appleton placed a coarse black bag over his head. The goon behind the wheel pulled out a lead-filled leather blackjack and slammed it hard into the American's midsection, doubling him over in pain. The one in back reached forward, handcuffed Appleton's compliant hands behind his back, and then pulled him upright in his seat. The B Company driver said nothing, but the thug in the back seat now said,
Yesterday, our job was to kill you. Today, it is to take you to see the boss. Your stock must be going up, old man.
Appleton said nothing. He was fucked and he knew it. But that was not all of it. He'd not said a word to anyone but the man who'd just betrayed him about Khan. And he hadn't even told him about the construction site or the dirty bomb. No one would be coming to help the gray man and the girl now. Not even Appleton himself. Priyanka Bhandari hacked into the wireless relay of the closed-circuit camera system in Express Tower 1 in a matter of minutes. Once in, she brought up all 105 cameras in and around the building, then individually selected the ones that looked the most interesting. She wanted a view outside, in front of Tower 1, looking over towards Tower 2, any view that might help if she needed to alert Cobalt to danger. She looked outside through the ocean spray, now wetting the windows, then hurriedly flipped through the cameras until she found the one that she was looking for, on perhaps her 20th try. She accessed the cam positioned over a north side service exit of Tower 1. To her pleasure, she found that the device was motorized, and by using her mouse, she could pan it higher, giving her a view of the construction site next door. She was able to zoom the camera, then tighten up the focus, centering it on the covered entry of Tower 2, identical in style and size to the one downstairs here in Tower 1. She leaned close to the screen, squinted, then went to work to improve the image, because she was beginning to pick out objects there on the drive that she needed to evaluate. Court exited the main door of Tower 1, zipping his raincoat up to his chin and tightening the hood before doing so. He passed a couple of bored security guards in the covered driveway and headed out into the open air. The wind was easily 35 miles an hour now, and the sea spray made it feel like his eyeballs were under fire from a BB gun when he faced towards the bay. He shoved his hands in his pockets and trudged to the north, planning on making his way into the seemingly abandoned garage alongside the 33-story building undergoing construction. He was halfway there when a voice came through his earpiece, barely audible over a driving gust.
Cobalt, hold!
He wasn't in an ideal location to hold. He was walking along a churning bay on the street in a monsoon.
What is it?
I have a long eye on the ground floor entrance into Tower 2.
What do you see?
I see multiple men standing just inside the door. I see vehicles under the covered entrance that have no business at a construction site. Expensive-looking SUVs.
Court said, B Company is guarding the location.
That's what it looks like from here.
Court started walking again.
Okay, I'll have to find another way to get inside the building.
What other way is there?
Priya asked, confused. Court looked up. Just west of the Tower 2 construction, the 5-story parking garage looked new but complete. On the top level of the garage was a massive construction crane. At its summit, the shorter, weighted counter jib faced the wind, and its long arm jib jutted out, parallel to the ground, and it swung left and right, shifting in the direction of the wind. This was called weather vaning in the industry, and it meant the turntable of the crane had been unlocked so the long vertical jib, high above the ground, could blow with the wind. If the jib had been locked, on the other hand, the force of a crosswind could literally blow the entire 260-foot tower down to the ground. The far end of the tower crane's jib, some 200 feet long and extending over the parking garage and the ground between the garage and Tower 2, ended right above the new building's roofline. There were other cranes around the building, but this was the only one that seemed to reach all the way to the top of the structure. Court realized the best way up was to ascend in the parking garage, then climb the massive tower of the crane, then shimmy out onto the long jib and make his way to the tall building. From there, he'd have to swing from the hook hanging from the bottom of the trolley until he could, hopefully, drop onto the roof. It was, in his estimation, just slightly less dangerous than walking into the lobby of the construction site and pulling out his pistol, then taking on all comers with gunfire. But it was at least somewhat less dangerous. He committed himself to this course of action and walked up the street, leaning to his left to combat the punishing wind coming from that direction. He had forgotten he was still connected to Priya.
Cobalt?
Sorry, yeah. I've got another way in. I'm going to be outside for a while, and where I'm going, I'm not going to be able to hear you, so I'll put my earpiece in my pocket till I get inside.
Okay,
she said.
Have you reached Appleton yet? Court asked.
Yes, Right when you left, he is aware about Tower 2. He says he'll alert the proper authorities immediately. They should be on the way soon.
Good. I'm going to try to get to that bomb before the cops get here, just in case Khan decides to blow it.
Do you know how to dismantle a bomb?
I'll Google it.
You'll what?
One thing at a time, Priya.
Okay,
she said nervously.
Good luck to you.
You too. Keep monitoring. Cort hung up the call and put his earpiece in the pocket of his jacket, zipping it closed just before climbing the chain-link fence around the construction site. He entered the garage and found it empty of cars and equipment. It had the new construction smell of concrete dust, and the wind made a loud whistling effect throughout the structure. Cort pressed on towards the stairwell at the center of the garage, but he remained on the outlook for security even here, inside the fence and still 50 yards away from the tower. He was glad he'd remained vigilant, because just as he came to the entrance to the stairwell, he smelled fresh tobacco. Someone was smoking, likely on the other side of the wall in the center of the garage, near the entrance to the stairs. If they were any good at their job, they would have an eye on the stairwell, so Cort figured there was a second stairwell entrance for people who parked on that side of the ground floor. Cort decided to bypass the stairs, and he jogged up the ramp of the parking garage up to the next level. A minute later, he approached the eastern stairwell entrance, ducked his head inside, and again smelled cigarette smoke. The man or men were below him somewhere, so Cort moved silently as he began climbing the stairs. On the roof, he stepped back out into the crazy wind. He fought to make it to the foundation of the crane, which he climbed up on, and then he slipped inside the skeletonized mast. If it were not for the wind and the spray from the bay, this would have been an arduous but relatively safe means of climbing. The metal beams had a ladder attached that ran all the way up to the operator's cab, barely visible in the heavy weather. But with the weather, this was extremely dicey, even for a man with Cort's training and dexterity. Each time he stepped on a new rung of the ladder, he made sure he had 3 points of contact, and though he ascended impressively fast, it wasn't one-third as fast as he would have liked. He climbed and climbed, worried about the fight he might find himself in after all the exertion he'd have to undergo over the next several minutes. 57. 12 years ago. The six men of Gulf Sierra crawled on their bellies, their rifles shifted to their backs as they moved through pine trees, only feet from the crest of the last hill, before arriving just northwest of the cluster of dwellings on the northern side of the fence line of Ismail Zai. They crested the rise and saw the tiny village, maybe a dozen little stone structures in all, on the leeward side of the hill just to the north of the compound wall. Looking into the old military base, they had eyes on the command building, but this shielded them from seeing anything beyond it other than the top of a control tower in the center of the base and a smaller guard tower at the front, still partially destroyed and blackened by the Hellfire missile Hightower had called onto it a month earlier. Hightower rolled onto his backpack now, pulled out his sat radio, and pressed the button for the talk.
Sierra Actual for home plate, over.
It was quiet on the hillside. Perspiration formed on Cort's face as he waited to hear the talk's response in his own headset. After several seconds, Zack called again.
Gulf Sierra 1 for home plate. How do you read?
There was no response. Zack looked down at the radio, then made a third and then a fourth call. Kendrick Lennox checked his watch.
Boss, we gotta be on target in 4 mics.
Zack tried the talk one more time, and then he switched to the short-range VHF-UHF radio, hoping to reach Lima Foxtrot, a kilometer or so to the south.
Sierra 1 for Foxtrot 1.
The response came quickly, though the distance between the two men was evident in the scratchy reception.
Go for Lima Foxtrot Actual,
Zack said.
I'm reading you 2x5, how me, over?
2x5.
Are you guys hearing from the talk? I tried to raise them but got nothing.
Same. Dead air.
Understood. Somebody's jamming the satellite.
Anderson's voice seemed fainter each time he spoke.
Last intel I got says the packs don't have sat jamming equipment.
You and me might be the lucky ones to find out otherwise.
Yeah, the hard way.
Zack said.
Op continues. We are on schedule. How copy?
Dwayne Anderson, somewhat to the south, replied.
Solid copy. The Rangers should hit in 3 mics. Then we are heading for the main gate. Foxtrot 1 out.
Zack rolled back onto his stomach, where he pushed himself up to his knee pads.
Let's hit those dwellings.
The six operators of Golf Sierra fanned out on the southern side of the darkened hillside as they exited the tree line, approaching the cluster of single-story structures just outside Ismail Zai base. There was no movement visible in the men's NODs, and all was quiet other than an occasional barking dog in the distance. Court had his rifle to his shoulder, his finger flat across the trigger guard and his safety off. Every step of his boots was measured to land as gently as possible. Even his breathing was slow, silent, and controlled. He'd skulked into harm's way many times in his career, and he knew how to be quieter than a cat when the situation called for it. Then, with a suddenness that surprised him, all need for stealth melted away. Gunfire to the south, dozens of rifles and machine guns all kicking off at the same time, told him the Rangers and perhaps even the SEALs were engaging KRF personnel at the base. As soon as the sustained fighting commenced, Zack spoke into his mic for the five other men stretched along the 20 meters of hillside.
Step it up,
he said, and all men increased their advance down the hill. Approaching the first building, Court took the lead, but Redis moved to the left, finding an angle on a side door to the little structure. He almost instantly fired a controlled pair of suppressed shots from his 416. Court couldn't see the target. He just advanced on an open window in front of him. Once there, he began to push a burlap curtain out of the way to scan inside, but Jim Pace stepped up to the window next to him.
Banger,
he said softly, and he dropped a canister inside onto the floor. Court just had time to roll his body away from the window and press it against the wall when a flashbang grenade began popping off multiple flares and booms inside the little building. As Court swung back into the window, Pace yanked the burlap away, and Court found a pair of men in front of him, both with Kalashnikovs in their hands. They were disoriented from the concussion, but had clearly been in the act of getting their weapons up after the suppressed shots dropped their partner in the side doorway. Gentry and Pace both fired on the men, sending them down to their backs. Pace fired another round into each man's head from a distance of 5 paces. Their bodies jolted and then went still. Zack's voice came through their headset.
What you got for?
Pace replied.
Two dudes in man jammies and AKs. They're EKIA.
Redis spoke up now.
Five has one EKIA at the side door.
The team moved on to the next building as the constant noise of gunfire made it clear that a massive battle was raging inside the base. Golf Sierra found nothing in the second structure, and the third was empty as well. In the fourth dwelling, Court was again the first man through the door, and with the aid of his night vision goggles, he saw a group of women and children all huddled together in the corner. The rest of Golf Sierra moved in behind him an instant later. Court dropped his rifle to his chest and raised his arms, yelling at his team behind him. He said,
"Hold fire! Hold fire!"
A woman stood up in the center of the group in front of him. A single gunshot cracked from behind. He saw the flash bounce off the walls around him, and he felt the pressure of a hot rifle round whizzing by his head. The standing woman's head snapped back, blood splattered the wall, and she dropped dead to the ground in front of the group. A black automatic pistol fell from her clutches and tumbled down onto the floor in front of her. All of the other women's hands went high. The kids followed soon after. Court turned around to face Hightower, who had just killed the armed woman.
How did you know she was armed?
Hightower looked past Court at the pistol on the ground. He stepped over and picked it up, shoving it into a dump pouch on his belt.
Didn't. I just didn't care for the way she stood up like that.
He shrugged.
Your lucky day.
Redis grabbed Court by the back of his neck now, brought his face so close the men's night vision equipment smacked into each other.
Toughen the fuck up, Six. Right now. Got it?
Court just moved past the others and back out of the building, while Pace and Morgan hurriedly began zip-tying the non-combatants. Soon, the stack set up to hit the next dwelling. Gunfire began cracking out of one of the windows, causing the Americans to rush wide of the line of fire, and then they hit it from the opposite side. Here, they kicked in a burlap door to find a dark room, where two teenagers wielded folded stock AKs and fired outside to the north without even aiming. Zack Hightower shot them both before either one ever saw the Americans. Finally, Court was first through the door in the building where the tunnel into the base originated, and he swept the small area with his rifle.
Clear,
he said, and Zack moved past him, up to a metal door at a 45-degree angle above the floor. Morgan said,
Looks like a storm cellar. Entrance to the tunnel,
Zack declared.
I'm opening it.
Court aimed his rifle along with the other four operators standing there. while Zack tried the latch. It did not give.
Dino, blow it. Roger that.
Redis hurried forward, but before he put a breaching charge on the door, he tapped it with the suppressor at the end of his rifle's barrel. He turned back to Hightower.
They hardened it. Something's behind the door. They might have filled in the tunnel.
Can you blow it through?
Hightower asked. Redis said,
I can blow through anything. I can't say this building won't fall down in the process, though.
He set a strip of sticky explosives at the tunnel's entrance, then looked back to Hightower.
We're gonna need a big bang.
Zack was listening to the incredible battle happening just a few hundred yards away, a battle he was missing.
Make it happen.
Copy.
Redis pulled another strip, and then a third, and he put them around the hinges of the welded door.
Clear out,
he instructed, and the other men left the building, taking cover behind the low wall of a nearby sheep pen. Redis joined them seconds later and made himself small behind the wall. In his hand, he held the detonator. Hightower squeezed Court's shoulder now.
Don't wait for the dust to settle. Get your ass into that tunnel and start moving. We're on your six.
Roger that.
Hightower looked at Redis and nodded.
Breach! Breach! Breach!
Redis said. Then he turned the dial on the detonator in his hands and plunged it in. Court's hearing protection saved him from blown eardrums, but the sound from the explosion 50 feet away was still deafening. As soon as the larger pieces of stone fell back to earth, Court climbed onto his feet and ran around the wall, charging into the building with his weapon raised, encountering smoke, dust, and still falling bits of debris. Inside, he found the door off its hinges and a wooden staircase leading down, half destroyed by Sierra 5's explosion. He knew his night vision equipment would be worthless in a tunnel with zero ambient light, so he flicked it up higher on his head as he descended. The bright light on his rifle would be similarly useless until he got past all the dust and smoke, so he didn't thumb the pressure switch to turn it on. He was halfway down the stairs in pitch black darkness, still feeling bits of debris floating back to earth and landing on his face, when the most rank smell he'd ever encountered filled his nostrils, so overpowering it made him stop in his tracks. Men began to pile up behind him on the stairs, so he called for them to hold where they were, then forced himself forward, still waiting for the dust down here to clear so his light would illuminate something more than the dirty air in front of him. He took in another lungful of breath and immediately gagged.
What the fuck?
He whispered. At the bottom of the stairs, the dust began to settle. He walked forward, kicked what felt like a large, full plastic bucket in front of him, and he stopped again. The rest of the men held positions on the stairs behind him. Court flashed his light ahead. There, as far as he could see through the narrow path, were rows of buckets lining both walls of the tunnel. He couldn't see what was inside, but he didn't have to see, because he could smell. Court transmitted on his headset.
Boss?
Zack was 20 feet behind now.
Jesus, what is that? I have like, I don't know, maybe 200 5-liter containers full of human shit down here.
Jim Pace muttered,
fuck me.
Morgan said,
this is their latrine?
Gagging, Court said,
I think they were just storing it here to hide it from us.
Hightower didn't respond. He just clicked his radio.
Mask up! That's pure methane you're breathing!
Court fumbled with his gas mask for several seconds, rushing to get it on before he passed out. Once on his face, he took a few breaths, each a little clearer than the last. Behind him, the others quickly donned their masks. Zack called to Court.
Can we pass through the tunnel?
I mean,
Court said.
We can. It's just not going to be fun.
No factor,
Zack said.
Continue.
This is nasty, boss,
said Redis.
Never promised you a rose garden.
Court had to squat to move through the roughly 5-foot-high tunnel, and as it was only 3 feet or so wide, he had to work to avoid the two rows of pales on his right and left as he headed south, closer to Ismail's eye. Behind him, the other men struggled along, muttering curses as they advanced. Lennox said,
this isn't the latrine for a couple dozen dudes. This is enough shit for 100 guys or more. They could have been here for weeks.
Hightower said,
yeah, that chat in Mexican chicken analysis that Six is boning called it. They've been hiding the number of packs on site here.
Court wasn't boning Julie, but he didn't argue the point. He was too busy trying to come up with a tactic to breathe less foul air to risk speaking any more than he absolutely had to. The god-awful stench made it through his mask's filter. It made him feel like he was going to pass out halfway through the tunnel, but he pressed on, kept his weapon high and his light beaming ahead, working hard to keep from putting a boot into a bucket and then spending the rest of the night with some Kashmiri separatist's waist halfway up to his knee pad. Mercifully, Kort found the terminus of the tunnel, and he climbed the steps to get him the hell out of there. This metal hatch was flush against the ceiling, not angled as the door at the origin had been, and it hadn't been barricaded either. The hatch was also unlocked, so he pushed it open by pressing his helmet against it, and he kept both hands on his weapon as he swept a small and dark storeroom. He was still using his Surefire flashlight on his rifle. There wasn't enough ambient light yet for his PVS-24s. The room was clear, but he noticed a massive splatter of dried blood on the cinder block wall in front of him. He swept the light on his barrel back towards the door, used his non-dominant hand to pull the hatch all the way up and lock it into place as he climbed out, and held his position so the rest of the team could leave the tunnel and the smell behind them. Zack was the third man out. He took off his mask and took a deep breath. It smelled like shit in this storeroom as well, but it wasn't one-tenth as bad as it had been in the tunnel. Kort had just taken his own mask off when Hightower flashed his light on the bloodstain. Holding it there, he whispered,
"Six." "Yeah? That's where your predecessor bought it."
Kort looked back to the stain, feeling an unspeakable despair overtaking him. He just headed for the door and cracked it open as he crammed his mask back in its pouch. Seeing a hallway with a little bit of ambient light shining through, he aggressively nodded his head down, and his PVS-24s fell back over his eyes. The path ahead formed into a hazy green but easily discernible focus. He waited for a squeeze on his shoulder from Rita's, and when it came, he headed out into the hall. To the immediate left was a chain door, presumably leading outside to the parade ground. Behind him, Hightower said,
"All hold."
Kort dropped to his knee pads, kept forward security with his rifle in the darkness, and listened as Zack tried to raise the other ground branch team, speaking in a whisper as he did so.
"Sierra Actual for Foxtrot Actual."
Kort could hear both sides of the transmission through his headset. Dwayne Anderson's own whispered voice came back in response to Hightower.
"Read you 5-5, Sierra."
"What's your location?"
"Command building, second floor. There's a sealed door here we're trying to get through. Then we'll clear up to the third, and then the roof. Negative contact so far. Where are you guys at?"
"Below you, first floor of the command building. We just exited the tunnel."
"Get outside, then over to the bunker to support 10 and 75th. Sounds like they're heavily engaged there."
"Copy that,"
Hightower said.
"We'll hightail it towards the Haz and try to raise Team 10 on the radio."
"Roger that. Good luck."
Zack ended the transmission by wishing Anderson luck as well, and then he spoke to Kort.
"Six. Through this door, across the parade ground, and over to the warehouse. On the far side of that, we should enter the action at the bunker."
"Roger that."
Kort took a large pair of bolt cutters from Morgan, then went to work on the chain lock holding the door. 58. Present day. Priya Bhandari sat in the office on the ninth floor of Express Tower 1 and continued cycling through the various camera views on her borrowed terminal. She was looking for evidence of B Company men in this building, and it only took her moments to find two men standing in front of a door in the 25th floor hallway outside the penthouse. They were shoulder to shoulder, facing the hall and the elevators. Looking them over, she decided these were not, in fact, B Company, but they were most definitely providing security for the door at the far end of the hall. She didn't recognize either of them from the distant camera angle, but she thought they could have been from the group of Pakistanis she'd seen around Khan that night in Easton Derry. All the pieces fit together. This, she told herself, could very well be where Khan was staying now. He wouldn't be over in a construction site waiting out a storm. He'd be close, in view of the location, but comfortable and out of the rain. If these were Pakistani security men, then it was, to Priya, a good indication that Khan was here now as well. She assumed he would want to be long gone when the bomb detonated, so she took this as a good sign that she wasn't about to be blown to bits or irradiated in the next few minutes. She didn't bother trying to reach Cobalt. She only told herself she had to remain vigilant until he came back online. She continued watching the 25th floor, only occasionally checking the other cameras. She was working under the assumption that if Khan was in the penthouse, He would stay hunkered down in Tower 1, but she couldn't be sure he wouldn't go somewhere else in the building. After almost 15 minutes of climbing the tower crane in what now felt like sustained 40-mile-per-hour winds, Court pulled his way up to the last few rungs below the operator's cab, just behind the operator's seat, and yanked it open, desperate to get a moment's respite from the weather. But instead of a moment's rest, he found a man sitting there, looking back over his shoulder at him in surprise. At first, Court thought the man to be a crane operator, a reasonable enough assumption considering the circumstances. But quickly the man shifted around, put his knee on the seat and faced the rear, and reached inside his raincoat towards his waistband. Court knew the tell of a man going for the gun in his pants. This was a B Company security man, given the supremely shitty job of watching the construction site from up here. And with the arrival of the gray man, this dude's job just got exponentially worse. Court executed his own draw stroke, but the B Company goon kicked his foot against the slew handle of the big crane, which turned the entire horizontal jib, including the cab, attached to it. Court was outside of the cabin still, and the sudden movement to his right had him spinning away, losing his footing on the wet railing of the tower. He dropped his gun, used both hands to grab onto a horizontal handle outside the cabin door, and swung back around as hard as he could, leading with his boots as he propelled himself into the cabin, striking the man there in the face and chest just as he got out his gun. The weapon clanked to the floor, bounced once, and flew out past Court, meeting the same fate as his own weapon, a 250-foot drop to the roof of a parking garage. Court had a folding knife in his pants, but no time to reach for it. He was on top of the Indian, and the man was still slewing the crane with his foot, turning it to the left. The heavy winds buffeted the cabin up here over 500 feet above the ground, and with the 200-foot jib no longer freely weather-vaning, the wind had more and more effect on the structure. This man might not have been much of a gunfighter, but he was a fighter, and he threw his body weight into Court, knocking him back through the open door, where Court again reached for the horizontal handle. He caught it with his left hand, but had to settle for grabbing for the open door latch with his right, and with these holds, he pulled himself up a few inches. The man inside the operator's cab swung a wrench he'd picked up from a shelf at Court's hand on the latch, but the American let go, then let go with the other hand and dropped out of view. The B Company security man hustled back into the cab, searching for his walkie-talkie, which had fallen somewhere on the floor during the fight. Court had fallen just feet before he caught a horizontal bar on the tower just behind the motor that turned the crane to the left and to the right, and he climbed back up as his enemy turned away from the door. Just as the man grabbed his handheld radio, Court dove back in on him, grabbed him in a headlock, smashed the radio with his fist, and swung the man around like a rag doll in the small space. The B Company soldier's right hand slammed into the control panel of the crane, and the motor room below them began to rumble. Court's first inclination was to push the man out the door to his death, but he decided on a more covert option. He held the man in a chokehold till he passed out, then cruelly snapped his neck. He let the body fall to the floor of the cab, then spun around and hit a red master stop button to turn off the motor. He didn't know what had happened, but immediately the jib began gently weather-vaning again, its long arm facing to the northeast over Tower 2. He sat down, exhausted from the climb and the fight, but his mind was still working. He told himself the fact that security had been posted all the way up here to protect the building meant his assumption that the bomb was here at the construction site was a safe one. He thought he had time to call Copper and check in. He was protected from the wind here and could possibly communicate. But then, a squawking sound grabbed his attention. There was a walkie-talkie on the floor next to him, and voices on it sounded to him like the Hindi-speaking men were performing a radio check. Shit. He had to move. 59. 12 years ago. As soon as the American force had been detected to the south of Ismail Zai, Murad Khan had sent dozens of fighters out to meet them, where they took positions behind sagged bag bunkers in trenches dug into the hillside that covered the bunker itself, and even prone on the tarmac. The fight kicked off instantly and had been raging for nearly 10 minutes now, while all four of the red and white helicopters remained behind the closed blast doors, still nose to tail in a straight line from the front of the huge space to the back. Omar Mufti had ordered the vehicles to be fully fueled inside the bunker, despite the risk the fumes posed, but this had been a time-consuming process. The only helicopter outside the hardened structure now was the Bell 412 that Mufti had flown in to the base with Murad Khan. The co-pilot was inside the Huey variant now, trying to find cover while pressed down against the seats. He'd started the ignition of the helo, and the rotor spun above him, but he remained on the ground, because he knew if he took to the air, he would likely be shot down, as enemy fighters were positioned by the hangars